Hello and welcome to the Thinking Poker Podcast. This is Andrew Brokus, and we've got Nate Mavis here as well. Hi, Nate.
Hey, how are you?
Our guest today is going to be Gareth Chandler. Might not be a name that you know quite as well as some of the people we've had on here, but I think in Nate and my opinion, he has one of the more interesting stories. So we're going to have a nice long talk with him, and Gareth actually has agreed to stick around and talk strategy with us as well. So I think we're going to switch up the order of things a little bit today. And Foucault reference there, by the way. Switch up the order of things a little bit today, and we'll talk. We'll do an interview with Gareth first, and then once you know him a little bit better, he'll stick around and talk strategy with us as well.
Yeah. So two things: if you got the Foucault reference, please email us podcast@thinkingpoker.net, and if you have anything else you want to talk to us about, also email podcast@thinkingpoker.net. The interview with Gareth is pretty important to me. I think it's valuable, and I think it's a nice contrast to the show we did with Vanessa. We have two people who are really smart and very capable and who got into poker and have tons of talent. And in their own ways, they're both getting what they bargained for. Vanessa's now made all these millions of dollars and is really famous and all that. And Gareth, you'll hear all about his story, but he dropped out and started moving all over the place and playing poker for a living. And he got, it seems to me, exactly what he bargained for and nothing more and nothing less. He's not rich. He's not famous, really. Although maybe he is now. I don't know. Maybe a lot of people listen to the show, but he's independent and he's making his living, but he's gotten, it's like he's the hero of a novel whose dreams come true and whose goals pan out, and in sort of the most appropriate and fitting way that you might not have expected.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. Gareth's a very literary character.
Yeah, I don't know. What do you want to say about Gareth?
Not a whole lot more, actually. I think let's let him speak for himself. I don't think he needs too much pumping up from us. I did have a story I wanted to tell you, though.
Let's hear.
Sort of a funny thing that happened to me at the local card room over the weekend. Just kind of a funny thing that I saw. You know, it's typical. You see a lot of internet poker players talk about primarily live poker players, and there's a very heavy note of disparagement, like that these people are, you know, idiots, dumb, donks, like all that sort of stuff. And I think it's just, if you're not connected to things like internet forums, poker training videos, books, friends who are really into poker, it's hard to get better. I mean, you just don't have a source of outside information about poker knowledge. You know, you kind of have to be exclusively self-taught, and you don't have a lot of role. If you're not playing with people who are a lot better than you are either, then you don't have a lot of role models or people to learn from. I think it's kind of easy to go down to lowest common denominator. And this was, I think, a good illustration of how that happens. So I was playing with this guy, and I haven't been to this card room too many times. So I'd only been there once before. So I don't know whether really this guy's a regular or not. But he definitely seemed to be like, I mean, he wasn't a lot better than other people who were there, but he seemed to be trying more, like really putting thought into what he was doing, and he just hadn't really reached like great outcomes yet. But there was a hand that he played against one of the weaker players at the table, where this player, the one who's trying to get better, he has King 10, and on the turn, the board is like King Jack 10, four or something. He calls a bet on the turn with his king 10, and then the river is a nine. So now it's like king jack 10 9 on the board, and the other player checks, and this guy chooses to check behind on the river, and he shows his king 10, and it's good. And then he says to the player on his right, you know, do you ever think about value betting there? Like, because I mean, he's probably not checking a queen, so there's a pretty good chance that the two pair is good. And this is a big leak that a lot of live players have, is just they're way too inclined to go to showdown and kind of seeing monsters rather than trying to hand read. They just like look at the board and they say, oh, he could easily have a straight. I'll be happy to take a showdown. Yes. Rather than really thinking about, well, you know, how likely it is that he checked a hand better than mine on the river? Pretty unlikely. So even if he's not real likely to call a bet, if you're pretty much guaranteed to have the best hand, you might as well bet. And it was like, you can see the light bulb is trying to go off on this guy's head. Like he's really trying to break through the fog. And the player next to him goes, no, man, the pot's big enough. It was kind of sad because you're saying, he's like, and then he agrees, you know, he's like, oh, okay, yeah, you're probably right. Like, it
It's
was really a shame. I mean, not a shame in the sense that, you know, it's a game I hope to play in more often, so I don't necessarily need people getting better, but it was a real good illustration of how people try and fail to get better when they don't have good people to bounce ideas off of.
It was so close, the light bulb, but
Yeah.
just not quite. Yeah. Do you think that young players are more likely to berate their opponents than other people? People say this all the time, and in my experience, it's just false. I mean, they do different things to make fun of their opponents when they do make fun of their
I don't
opponents.
necessarily mean to their face, but I mean, I do think like it's just the way that people talk on internet poker forums or amongst themselves, when certainly when those people aren't around, I think there's a strong undercurrent of disdain for these primarily live players or
Yeah.
people who just haven't studied poker in the same way that like the average online player does.
Yeah, that's right. Although live players have a lot of disdain for young internet players behind their
Yeah.
backs too. So,
Yeah. I'm just less privy to those conversations, I guess.
yeah, I was wondering if you had a view about that, because it's something that almost everybody believes, and I think it's just false. If somebody disagrees with me, podcast@thinkingpoker.net. But this conversation will go better if we bring Gareth in. How about that?
Yeah, let's get him on here.
All right.
Our guest today is Gareth Chandler. He plays primarily the No Limit Hold'em Zoom games on PokerStars. Gareth blogs and produces videos for card runners, and he's an instructor at PokerStars Poker School Online. Poker's enabled Gareth, is still enabling Gareth, to do some really interesting things in his life, but we're going to let him tell you about that himself. So thanks for joining us today, Gareth. So is it fair to say that you, how do you want to put this? After a couple of aborted attempts at college, you ended up dropping out and moving to Peru?
Ordered has such a finality.
Yeah, maybe just not yet completed.
I just mean that I went back for more punishment on more than one occasion
Right.
before discontinuing. So
What was the name of the university?
I went to Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario.
Oh, that's right. And then you went to the university in Texas, right?
So before Queen's, I went to SMU,
That's right.
Southern Methodist.
Yeah, that was strange.
I mean, I have my reasons at the time, I guess.
I hear it's really fratty there. It's a big.
Yeah, that was a big turnoff. One of the main reasons I went was the swim team. So I was a fairly high level swimmer. I don't know how to, properly put that in context, but they had a pretty good Division I team. And I had a friend who was on the women's team, so I thought, I had a really good shot at walking on. And I ended up walking onto the team, which was good. I really liked the climate, and those were the only two things I liked about
The
the whole place. So I didn't end up
weather
lasting.
climate, not the cultural climate, I take it.
Yeah, the weather climate. I went actually in 2004, so in November of my first semester, Bush was getting reelected, and I was interested in this girl, and she was like, "Oh, I've got, we weren't dating, but we were seeing each other." And she comes up to me one day, like end of October. She's like, "Oh, I got the best news. Bush is making this like SMU his last stop on the campaign trail. It's gonna be a huge blowout rally. Isn't that awesome?" And I was just like, "Oh man, this is rough."
Ouch. And
That's kind of,
did you keep seeing her after that? That's
I saw her like brief. Yeah, I saw her still for a period, but nothing came of it. So.
So let's talk about swimming. I have a swimming background. My family has a swimming background. I mean, how long were you swimming? I guess here's what I want to say about swimming. You'll tell me what you think, which is that some of my first exposure to situations where you had to focus for a long time and be responsible for your own development without anyone else who could really tell how hard you were working and how much you were improving. I learned a lot of that first from swimming and then applied it later, hopefully, to academics, to other things, and to poker, where I learned about that some more. I think swimming was one of the big sort of character developing things I did in my youth and early adulthood. Do you have that kind of romanticized attachment to swimming? Like what role did it play in your life?
No, I think romanticized is a very good word, and so is character development. I wonder why you would say that you had to have discipline and work hard sort of outside of supervision. Like when I was swimming, we were training like 10 times a week, say when I was 13, with the team, and, you know, everyone is in the pool. So, and the coach is there on the deck. So the coach sees pretty much every lap you do. What I was thinking
okay. mostly is that a lot of what's important happens in your own mind. It's the attention you pay to something right. that's very repetitive. I mean, it ought to be repetitive. If you're doing it right, it's very repetitive. And right. I mean, the difference between 95% effort and 100% effort is, I think it's something that's not really third personally accessible very much. And a lot of the stuff that's happening in your own mind is even less visible. And my own sense was that that's something that happens in swimming more than in other places, where if you're slacking off a bit, it's hard for anybody else to tell, and it requires an extraordinary feat of the will to stay attentive and to really keep on improving as much as you can.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, certainly there was this dynamic that emerged amongst the team sometimes of this person is slacking. Actually, we would have that Jaron slacking, just to describe someone who people suspected weren't giving a full effort or weren't committed to like being the best individual swimmer they could be. You know, that was sort of like just a peripheral thing, I think, that happened to people who were growing out of it or losing, you know, just weren't in the thick of it, I guess, mentally anymore. I don't know how to like put this in like the best way, but I never had that problem. I was if anything, I was always way too motivated. I had a big problem with not going 100%. So, you know, if there was a time like to do drills, something like that, I wanted to be the first one to finish all the time. So I had a lot of problems with just being way too competitive, and then struggling with, you know, when things don't go your way and you're like 14, you take something too seriously, that can have a really bad effect on your mindset. So I had to learn a lot character-wise sort of on that side of things, I guess.
That's interesting, because one thing I've heard about your dropout story, or your sort of deconversion from academia, if you want to call it that, is that it wasn't so much apathy or slack, but I think your phrase was taking responsibility for your own happiness, which sounds like much more of a positive, proactive decision to me. Is that right? Did I get that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good synopsis of it. I mean, for whatever reason, I grew up in a culture of university as achievement and as like intellectual development as university.
Okay.
And I, for whatever reason, had a problem separating all of those things, separating intellectual development, university, and achievement. So, yeah, I mean, I stuck it out longer than I should have. I should have dropped out earlier and not gone back if I had been more mature, self-confident. Like if I had had confidence in my convictions or what I seemed to perceive to be the case for me, I just wouldn't have gone back. And I did that twice.
What was it that you didn't like? I mean, it seems like you're a pretty, I mean, not just a smart guy, but like an intellectual guy. I mean, you're into books and all that learning sort of stuff. You seem like you would be a good fit for the university to me.
Yeah, that was certainly another issue. Like I had those, you know, people would say things like that to me, and I would feel that way as well to a degree. I mean, I had issues with authority, I can say that too. Yeah, not necessarily in terms of it existing per se. I mean, I certainly had a bigger problem with it when I was going to compulsory high school. So I remember one time my seventh grade teacher or something like that pulled me aside and said, you know, I forget what I had done, but she said, do you just not think the rules apply to you? And, you know, at the time I was tongue-tied, and later on I felt like I had transgressed or whatever. But the correct answer, in my opinion now, was yes, the rules don't apply to me. Basically, anyone who wants to just be, you know, I don't know what the best way to put it would be, but I was not, I really try not to be too condescending, but like I was beyond what we were doing. So the rules shouldn't have applied to me. Like I didn't need to be there. So there's a lot of that. I mean, a lot of that happened pretty much at every point in my education. I just felt like I could be doing things a lot further along, or I don't need to be doing things this way or that way. I remember I transferred from private school in grade 11 and 12, which are the last 2 years of high school in Canada, to a public school. And I had like grade 11 chemistry, and my chemistry teacher was marking an assignment or something. And he was like, oh, Gareth, you have to like collect like terms when you solve this equation. I just like wanted to die when he said that. I was like, are you serious? You know, like this is what I have to do for the next 2 years is like collect like terms for these people. Like I've been like years past that, you know? So yeah, just the idea of wasting time doing, and you know, as an adult, like I understand that there's this underlying dynamic of, Nate, you actually work for one of these institutions.
No. But go ahead. I mean, this is the show isn't about me, but I mean, yeah, I am a grad student. Yeah, I do teach, and I'm heavily invested in the academic life in a certain way. But I mean, this only came after, you know, a couple of years of wandering around the country and playing cards and freelancing and doing things on my own. And although I think it's the right thing for me to be doing, I certainly don't think it's perfect. And I certainly don't think that there aren't systemic problems and things like that. So,
I've had a lot of conversations with high school kids in your shoes, Gareth, who are, and probably even going to schools that are much less academically rigorous than the high school that you were in, where the kids really were just sort of way too smart for where they were. And I mean, I basically had to have very pragmatic conversations with them of essentially just like, you know, go along to get along. And it's important to have that diploma, even if you have to do a lot of dumb crap to get it.
I mean, I think it's valuable. I think the things I do are valuable, but I don't think that class time is never wasted or that everything functions perfectly. Or that a lot of education just isn't a bunch of signaling. So anyway, so don't worry about it.
No, I just, you know, I just want to obviously say this is coming from one perspective and not, you know, haven't sat in your classroom or anything. Class-wise, I mean, I took two classes that were of interest to me, and I probably went to half of those, and the other classes I just had no time for. I mean, I just wasn't interested. Nothing grabbed me. And I actually feel pretty like I let myself down because I had this first year poli sci class, Pulse 110 or whatever. And the head of the department of poli sci teaches it. So this is a really good idea because he's the best like lecturer and professor in the department. he gets the first years, and they all think, oh man, Poli Sci is going to be just like amazing, right? Because this guy is just the shit. So Nossel, it was his name, Professor Nossel, gives these amazing lectures, and then people take Poli Sci as their minor or whatever, or major, and then in second year you get the like not the worst imaginable, but people who just, you know, couldn't make Van Gogh interesting if they tried. So I wrote him an email in first year complaining about something ridiculous. I was complaining about essays, the way he wanted them. I think I was complaining about the way he wanted them like typed out on the page, like formatting things. You know, he was saying we'd get a zero if we didn't format them in the way he wanted, or something like that. There must have been something more to it, though. I can't remember, but there was some class policy or something he said. And I just said, you know, like, this is, like, why do you lower yourself to this kind of social reproduction bullshit? You know, I was, I'm sure I was like ensconced in Chomsky and Mark. And he just wrote back and said, you know what? This is an opt-outable institution, you know. Like, if you have better things to do, if you could do it on your own, you are free to leave. And he didn't mean that in the, like, you know, paternal way where it's, like, not a choice. Like, he was like, it is a choice, you know. And I just wish I took his advice earlier.
Did you ever write back to him and say, you know, by the way, I dropped out and I'm playing poker on the internet and backpacking through Peru? Did you ever write him?
No,
Would you please do that and send me the response?
Yeah, I mean, I can only imagine what he thought after getting that email, because, you know, it could... I don't know if you've read the Unabomber Manifesto.
Were you playing poker at this time also? I mean, is that part of what's distracting you? Or not distracting you, but when you say, like, you don't have time for this other stuff, I mean, is poker one of the things that's more interesting to you than some of your classes at this point?
Honestly, not really. No, like I haven't been playing poker that long. I've only been playing it for 4 years now. And I was as disillusioned as you could be before I made an online deposit. Like, the two weren't really weren't in sync, I guess. But I mean, I did start playing poker in college, and it did become a time sink. It did become something I spent, you know, a good amount of time doing instead of going to class or just going out in general. I mean, I became in a very bad way. Like, I became pretty depressed.
I mean, did poker contribute to your depression, do you think? Was it a way in, a way out, or what?
I think it was, it wasn't good for my day-to-day. When I started, one, I had money, so playing for money wasn't a good idea when I was beginning, because I was a losing player, like, naturally the first time. Well, maybe not naturally, but it just so happened that I was a losing player when I started playing. So having no money and losing money, not a good combination. Two, solitary. Like, I got into playing it after... the chess team met, so I was playing chess, like, for the school, and then one of these grad students was playing probably like 5-10 and 10-20 on, like, party poker or something like that, and he would get us on Thursday nights to after chess to go play poker till like 3 a.m. or 5 a.m. you know. So being alone in my room playing $5 sit and goes, probably not the best thing for someone, you know, depressed in the thick of Canadian winter. And then, you know, staying up till 5 a.m, you know, that disrupted my sleep schedule, things like that. So none of those things were good. None of it was particularly productive or profitable or anything like that. But it was just, you know, just another thing that I was doing. So it did become a way out, though, because when I started to actually learn things and take things kind of seriously and think maybe I could use it to get the fuck out of here, then I became very motivated. And I think a lot of good things happened after that. Because, you know, obviously poker teaches you a lot of, I don't know about pain tolerance, but just variance tolerance. You know, I became very tolerant to losing, and not in a bad way, not in like a, I'm a degen, I don't care about, you know, throwing this bankroll away. Just like, okay, well, I'm going to stop now. I'll pick this up tomorrow, you know, and get back at it. So it taught me a lot of discipline like that, emotional control, a lot of self-reliance, I guess, you know, it was all my doing. Like I didn't have anyone telling me this was a good way to go. I didn't have anyone encouraging me, like a lone cut off place. And this was just sort of my way to get out of that.
When you were saying poker could be a way of getting out, did you mean out of university or out of Canada or just out of your depression?
I mean, I knew I had to, I knew I just couldn't stick around failing classes. And like in Kingston particularly, winter is just bleak.
Okay, so bleak winter in Kingston, and Gareth and many other students at Queen's are in the midst of a deep depression.
Straight out of the brothers. I don't know. I mean, it was, I'll tell you what happened. I mean, the first thing that happened was that I already wasn't in school for the September semester. And I've been playing on and off throughout the summer, just online stuff, like literally like $5 and $10 18 man sit and goes. That was what I played for the most part. I think I probably had to withdraw something, you know, like $1,000 at some point to buy food. So
where are you living at this point? You're not in the dorm if you're not in the university, right?
Yeah, I'm in an apartment with three other math majors, pure math majors. So we were all, that was my supposed major. So yeah, so I didn't have much money on Full Tilt. Like I'd taken whatever like $2 hour per hour profit I grinded out. And I can't remember the number, but I had something like less than $150 on my account. And I decided to play a $26 tournament like 2 or 3 weeks before I'd finally saved up enough Full Tilt points to get a Card Runner subscription for a month. I had my eye on that all summer, and I was like, oh, if I could get that, you know, I'd be on to something. So anyways, I got the subscription, I watched some videos, and then I came second in this $26 tournament that was like, you know, 1/6 of my bankroll or whatever. And it was for $4,200. And I was like, oh my God, I'm filthy rich. Like, I just thought this was it. So I actually did escape from the winter that year. I just went off to Peru for like 2.5 months. And then when I came back, I tried to go back to school the following September, I think, or maybe even the summer, tried to start back in the summer. That didn't work out too well. And I mean, I just, after that, like a whole year passed, I guess. And going into the next summer, I had dropped out another time. So I went to Peru until March. And a year later, I dropped out the last time. And going into that summer, I just thought, I've got to do something to not repeat this cycle and get out of this town. And I knew Peru was cheap. So I knew, you know, I'd been there before. I thought I could maybe navigate it semi-reasonably. So I spent the whole summer just grinding Rush, like 25-0 and 50-0. I probably played upwards of like 600,000-700,000 hands over the summer into the fall. And after all that, it was a lot for me. at the end of all that, I had like a 15K bankroll, and that's what I took off to Peru with. So, you know, I quote unquote made it or whatever. I had 15K bankroll and probably like 3K on my credit card. So I thought this was like more than sufficient to buy a one-way ticket and survive. So,
I mean, this is interesting, right? Because, like, on the one hand, you're obviously a smart guy and you obviously have the tools to succeed. But I find myself having like two different reactions to your story. One is like, isn't it great you found poker, which can be so empowering and can reward intellect and hard work and things like that. And then I also find myself thinking that it's a miracle that you didn't ruin your life, you know, at the beginning, gambling with money you couldn't afford to be gambling with, plus, you know, dealing with some mental issues and buying a one-way ticket to Peru, planning to use, you know, a credit card balance if you needed to. I mean, you're obviously a smart and very skilled person, but do you ever think that you got lucky somewhere along the way to not destroy yourself, or
to be honest and frank, I think I got unlucky in almost all regards. Like, I don't know, you know, how far down this rabbit hole you want to go, but things got really bad at some points. I guess the best way to answer your question is like, what I feel like I had no other choice. Like, you know, you had this preamble of like, oh, I'm a smart guy, I have things going for me. You know, no one was offering me any help in terms of like, oh, hey, you'll get this job if you just get through this, or hey, here's this solution. You know, I was pretty much estranged from my family at the time, and I still am to a large degree. I didn't have, you know, connections or ways into places. I mean, I just didn't see, I mean, I had this feeling that, you know, you've done things like, you know, like I did well on the SATs. I, you know, got like 100 on my grade 12 English exam. I had these ideas that, yeah, I should be like a successful person in society, but I didn't, there was no proof in the pudding. There was no, you know, there's just like literally no one was knocking on my door, or when I sent in things, you know, I would just get no response or rejection or stuff like that. So, I mean, I, you know, like, I would just say, as opposed to what, like the, you know, what else could I have done? And the question about like destroying myself or things like that, I mean,
it's one of these things where I know you and you seem like a person who is going to succeed, who has resources of intellect and of character to get yourself through problems and to succeed at what you put yourself to, right? But I can't help but be struck by the beginning of your story, which sounds like the beginning of any thousands of bad stories, which end with people ruining their lives, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's an alternate universe where we're asking you what it's like to work as a male prostitute in Peru.
Well, I mean, financially, that certainly is in play all the time. Like, that's not like not the specifics of this, but like, financially, I'm not secure whatsoever. Like, I have a job now that I get steady income from. I have two jobs now between Card Runners and Poker Stars that I get steady income from. But I don't have a lot of money. I had a lot less money than I have now when I came back from Las Vegas. So, I mean, yeah, financially and all that stuff, there's certainly, like, I've certainly been taking large gambles. But yeah, financially, my response would be to say, like, as opposed to what? Like, the, you know, mental health stuff, I don't really have a good explanation except to say that, like, I always had a philosophical disagreement with the viability of suicide. And, you know, here I am. So, you know, that sort of commitment, philosophical commitment, I guess, was strong enough that while it certainly entered my mind and is, it's not like I'm Mr. Happy-go-lucky, I was not, you know, I wasn't buying supplies at the Breaking Bad hardware store or whatever. I don't know how much that answers your
question. No, it answers it to a large degree. So you didn't find the academic rat race or parts of academia, you didn't find that fulfilling. There were other things about society that you found silly and unfulfilling. Yet, I think anyone who's met you, you seem, yeah, you've got a lot of vitality. You're an interesting guy to talk to. You seem to have a lot of energy. Where does that come from? I mean, I know where it comes from for me, and I share some of these attitudes, I think, but what gets you out of bed in the morning? What lights your fire? I mean,
wow,
my point is, you seem to be the sort of person who requires a reason to get out of bed in the morning. The things that are around you, the things that are around you do not automatically motivate you, right?
Right. Right.
Yet you seem very motivated. And given that you require, I think, maybe more reason than a lot of people do to get motivated, you know, what is it? What, you know, what gets you going?
I'll try and be succinct. Like, there certainly was a point in my youth, as I'm sure there's in many people's youth, where I was felt entitled. So when I wasn't getting things basically my way for free because, you know, I had whatever talent or whatever, I felt like, you know, something was wrong in the world, that I wasn't getting what I wanted. I began to view the world as like a very, basically, you know, things don't come for free in this world. You've got to work for what you want, whether it's money or whatever it is. So things aren't going to be handed to you. That became something I became aware of and, you know, a central tenet of my thinking, I guess. I never didn't enjoy certain things about life. Like, I always enjoyed women, always enjoyed culture, books, movies, and good food and travel. So even at my lowest point, like, those things were always things that my palate never like became gray or whatever, you know, it didn't turn into the Matrix or anything like that. So I always had those things beckoning to me. And I guess from swimming, we talked about earlier, like, I had a preset ability to work hard. I knew what working hard was, and I knew I could do it. So, you know, the knowing what hard work was and how to do it, put that together with the idea that you're not owed anything, and enjoying things about the world, enjoying reading Montaigne, you know, and traveling to new places, trying new food, enjoying paying for a woman's dinner, you know, having favorite things. Like, that all seems to me very like a very logical reason to want to get out of bed in the morning and work hard.
Fuck yeah. The world's full of amazing things. That sounds, I mean, it sounds like the best possible answer.
Yeah, so.
So where do you go from here? I mean, I think you're unique among a lot of people. I mean, a lot of people have at least tried to do some things sort of structurally similar to what you do. A lot of them are back in 9-to-5s now. A lot of them are out of poker. A lot of them are doing whatever. I think you're somewhat unique in that you're still taking responsibility for your own happiness, in your phrase, and living the poker life and trying hard at it, you know, at this sort of drifting life. Where do you go from here? Is that the plan from here forward?
Yeah, that is definitely the plan from here forward. I mean, I came back from Vegas pretty much broke, to be perfectly honest. And I'm not proud of that at all, actually, to be honest. Like, I don't romanticize degeneracy or bad bankroll management. I feel like I, to an extent, let a number of people down going broke. But yeah, so I had a pretty clear option of when I came back to opt out of the drifting poker lifestyle, if you want to put it that way. And like, I knew I had the option, but it just never, I never took it seriously. Like, I always wanted to get back to traveling and playing poker and, you know, deriving my income from poker. So your question is, where do I go from now? Well, I've been in Canada for 3 months, getting out of debt and sort of rebuilding a bankroll. I do have kind of a real job, if you can call it that, with PokerStars. I teach for them for Poker School Online. So, you know, I teach two classes a week at set times. And, you know, though I can do it from anywhere, I have my laptop and a Wi-Fi connection. You know, it's certainly like a job. I'm accountable to, you know, someone for it. I really enjoy it, as it so happens, and it has to do with poker. So I don't know how, you know, well it fits into certain definitions, but long story short, I've already bought my next one-way tickets. so
really? Where is it?
In a month I'm flying to Bogota in Colombia, and I'm going to be there for 2 weeks. That's going to be more of a vacation than anything. Like, it's not like I've just been printing money that I could take a 2 week, you know, like all expenses paid vacation. But I'm going to be there for 2 weeks, and you know, my classes, I've taken the 2 weeks off of my work. I'm probably not going to put in a lot of hands. Then I'm going to Peru. And I'm going to be there for 4 months, probably, more or less. And I'm going to be living in Lima. And my plan is to grind. Like, I'm going to be on the grind. I've got to get Supernova by the end of the year. So, yeah, I'm going to be grinding on that. After that, I'm going to go to Ireland for a week just to visit a friend of mine who lived with me in Vegas. And then after that, it's the most exciting thing. So at the end of March, the last day of March 2013, my friend is getting out of the Turkish army, and I'm going to go to Turkey to see him.
Fantastic.
And yeah, I'm going to live. We're going to travel to Greece and Turkey for 3 or 4 months. Then after that, I'm probably going to go to the other side of Asia. That's my plan, to go Southeast Asia.
Fantastic. You're going to be financing this with some combination of playing poker and working for card runners and poker stars?
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. I mean, I have no other sources of income. Yeah. So. Yeah. I mean, I already bought tickets.
If you're listening to this, and if you have odd jobs that need doing by a smart person that can be done over the internet from around the world, podcast at thinkingpoker.net.
Or if you have work that needs to be done in Colombia, Peru, Turkey, Greece,
Ireland.
I'm always down for a day of manual labor in a good cause. I guess the answer is resolutely, I'm sticking with the lifestyle for the time being.
Well, I feel like we kind of we skipped over some. I mean, not that everything hasn't been interesting, but we kind of took a giant step over the year or close to a year that you spent living in South America, and you had, as I recall, some pretty cool stories from that time. I know the one I just read on your blog, which I don't think you had told me this one before, about nearly winning the, was it a bed beat jackpot?
in South America, I mean, I thought it was just in Peru, but in South America, I guess, they don't have a bed beat. And I had this American friend in Lima who said they instead they have a good win. So if you table a very strong hand, you just get more money. So you win the pot and you get like a bonus, and the person who got bad beat, you know, they get nothing. They don't get anything. So I got all the money in at a cash game, drawing pretty close to dead. I had King Jack of diamonds on a 10-10 six board with two diamonds. I got it in versus sixes full, but I turned perfect on the Queen of diamonds. And if I hit the nine of diamonds and had a straight flush, the good win would have been 2,300. And if I hit the royal, the good win would have been 4,600. And at the time, I was in Guayaquil, Ecuador. And I had just got there like 3 days before. And I hadn't, you know, like I just didn't know the place very well. So I was when the queen came off on the turn, like I looked at the floor manager, and the floor manager I was pretty sure owned the place as well. I looked at him and he looked at me, and I was starting to think, just the way he looked at me, like, you're gonna have to work to get the money potentially. You know, like I sat down in the game thinking there was probably a 5%, like a 1 in 20 chance that it was crooked, just like my radar. Yeah, so that combined with like this very strange circumstance, the fact that he knows I'm a gringo, like just the way I spoke Spanish was very poor. Like there's no chance I was local. You know, like I might have a flight to catch out of the city in like 48 hours. You know, he could just sit on the money for 48 hours and I'd have to decide, you know, to try and get it or to leave. So all this is happening like as the turn card comes down, right? And it's just like,
so you're sweating a lot more than a two outer.
Yeah, I was a lot of things were going through my head, but I bricked it out, so it didn't end up coming to fruition or anything.
And you've played poker in how many different countries in South America?
Just Peru and Ecuador.
What are the casinos like there? I mean, are you, do you feel like you're playing against like drug kingpins and stuff? I feel like that's the stereotype of
Not especially. Like a lot of the people are between the United States and Lima, so they probably own a nice house in Lima and they own a nice house in Miami and they commute between the two. So those are most of the regular donators to the game. So
well, that doesn't rule out drug kingpin.
No, it doesn't. There's no sure way for me to be able to tell, you know, like the one story I remember telling you that did, well, I guess there were two times that I became suspicious like something was coming up. The first time, basically, I would play 200 NL. That's converted to US. It was 500 soles in Peru. I played 200 NL, you know, four nights a week. Sometimes on Fridays, they would run 400 NL. And I would always want to play that if they were spreading it, because like, if anything, the players who played 400 were worse than the players who were just like playing 200 every day.
Yeah, that's a common feature of live rooms.
Yeah, so I came in one night on a Friday and the guy, one of the floor people said, oh, 400's running in like the VIP room. So I went up there to play 400 and just a dream scenario happened. This guy sat down two to my right. So I guess not total dream because he'd be on my direct right, but he was two to my right. He had like a $10,000 at least. I'm not an appraiser of watches, but this watch he was wearing had to be worth in excess of $10,000. And the first hand he played, he got a full stack in with like second pair, when the flop went like bet raise free raise, and I was just like, oh my goodness, like I was ready to, you know, I was ready to go to the ATM for a lot of bullets, you know. I knew this, what kind of spot this was and everything else. So anyways, he has a bodyguard, and this bodyguard doesn't work for the casino. I know that because I've been going to this casino all the time, and I know the people who work there, and I know that this is his personal bodyguard, and his bodyguard is packing a hand cannon. Like, to say he was packing, he would be understatement. Like, he had this jumper on, like a, I don't know, like a jumper, like a zip up kind of wind jacket, I guess. And it was just like unzipped a little bit, and you could see this giant gun in a holster, like on his hip. So, I just mean it was a really big gun, like physically big. I don't know anything about how you judge guns.
So you're also not an appraiser of guns.
Yeah, I'm not an appraiser of guns, but I've seen guns, you know, like the cops on the street will carry a gun, like a pistol or whatever. And this was like not one of those. This was like a really big gun. And I was just thinking at the time, like, who could this guy be that they would let him into the casino with, like, let the bodyguard into the casino with a giant gun? Like, it was almost like, I don't know, it just seemed too surreal to be true, you know? Like, you just like, how could they let this guy in? You know, this is like out of the movies or something, out of a bad movie. So there was that. And the guy spoke English, actually. And, he ended up not being one of the people with a house in Miami. He had a house in like near Toronto, actually a place I knew of. But anyways, he was a huge fish, and, you know, I won a decent chunk of money off of him. And it was just seemed extremely likely that something untoward was, you know, about him that didn't add up, because like a lot of rich people for Peru go to that casino, and none of them, some of them have their, you know, female escorts with them, or, you know, just friends, or their, you know, butler or whatever people call it. And none of them had a bodyguard with a giant gun. I knew the staff knew he had a gun, and the staff was like, you know, in the VIP room was like bringing everyone food at the table and treating everyone like real nice, you know? So there's something awry. And I obviously didn't ask the guy, like, yeah, so why? This one guy got into a hand with him, and I can't remember the exact action right now, but it went something like, it was 3-bet pre-flop. And then the flop went like donk, raise, re-raise, call. And the turn went like check shove on a king high board. And this other guy in the pot with the terrible tourist who had check shoved on him was really drunk. And his English was okay. So the tourist was trying to like table talk to him. Like, he asked this question. Remember, the action went 3 bets before flop, 3 bets on the flop, and then a check shove. And the question that the tourist asked was, do you have the king on the board? The lot of money has changed hands. It's pretty late into the night, and this other guy who check shoved is really drunk, and he's like, oh, I don't know, you know, like tee hee hee, you know, whatever, having a good time at the other guy's expense. And the other guy asks, like, will you show me if I fold? I have two queens. I'm watching this from across the table. Like, I don't drink at the table, you know. I'm very locked into the situation. It doesn't seem like anyone else is realizing what's going on. This guy is like, maybe I'll show you a bluff, you know. And I'm just like, and then so he says those things, and then after a little bit, he's, you know, like 20 seconds, he's like, no, okay, I have the king, I'll show you. And the guy is like, has been very jovial to this point, and says, okay, I'm gonna fold. And then his voice changes in this tone, and he's like, but if you're lying and you don't give me that king, like, I'm gonna, you know, it's gonna be the fucking end of it. And the guy laughs, you know. I don't know what how he said it. It wasn't like super directly threatening, but if you're looking at it from my perspective, I'm just thinking, like, this is not going to end well if this guy doesn't have a king, because this fish is being very serious right now.
Yeah, that's actually a pretty good thing to say, even if he has no intention of hurting him after right. after the game is over. Just it's a pretty good way to get a physical reaction from the guy.
Yeah. Anyways, he did fold. The drunk guy showed a king, and I was just very thankful for that.
Yeah, that's...
the guns weren't coming out.
I didn't know that the bodyguard had a giant gun. Like, that was the thing. It seemed to me like he was just walking into like a moving train, like, and you know, there's nothing I could do at the time but watch. The other time was just a guy threatened to kill me at the table all of a sudden. I can't say that was unprovoked. I certainly did something to provoke it. His reaction, wildly disproportionate. I did say something I shouldn't have. And that too also became a situation where, like, the tone of the situation just changed very rapidly. And I thought, like, you're in a situation where this is, you know, real, and you need to, like, extricate yourself. A guy bad beat another guy, or excuse me, it was a flip before the flop, like ace queen versus ninth, and they got it all in on a queen high flop, and the guy in question had ace queen. When the board ran out clean and he took the other guy's money, he said, "Welcome to Peru," to this guy. And the guy with nines had just sat down like five hands earlier, so I assumed that they didn't know each other, because the guy had just sat down, and to say, like, "Welcome to Peru" to a total stranger would be obviously very bad etiquette. So, forgetting myself, I, like, "Do you know I was just, like, saying that?" And, of course, the guy heard me, because I was just, like, talking out, thinking out loud. And the guy said, I'll remember this verbatim. He said, "It's because it's my country." Because I was like, "What?" "It's because it's my country that I get to say that." And again, forgetting myself, I said, "Well, that sounds like a really stupid reason." There weren't many words exchanged between that point and the point that he said, "I'm going to kill you. Like, I'm going to fucking kill you. You better, you know, get the fuck out of here. You don't know, like, who I know," stuff to this extent. That got the hell out of there.
Smart move.
Yeah, I think so.
And another smart move would be for us all to go freshen up our drinks and come back and talk some strategy. So let's do that.
This is a hand that was submitted to me by a blog reader and a podcast listener named Dana. And it came from a 1-2 live game that he was playing in Las Vegas. He said he'd only been in the game about 2 orbits, so he didn't have a lot in the way of history or reads. So the hand in question, we've got the under-the-gun player limping in for $2. Dana makes it $8 with jacks in middle position. The button calls, and Dana says that this is the first pot that he's seen the guy on the button play, so some indication that he might be tight. The blinds fold, and the limper calls. So it means we've got $26 in the pot, $27 less the rake. And the three of them see a queen 10-4 rainbow flop. Under the gun checks. What do you guys want to do at this point with pocket jacks? Queen 10-4 flop.
I think there are a lot of good standard reasons to bet. You don't want to give a free card. There will be worse hands that can call. You don't want to give a free card. You don't love your hand, and you don't love the idea of getting raised, because you can't fold easily and you can't call easily. But I think betting's better than checking here. What do you think, Gareth?
Do we know the limper stack size? Is he 200 effective.
Both of these players, I'm glad you asked, actually. Dana said he had $180 to start the hand, and both of these players covered him. I'm not sure how Under the Gun stacks up against Button, but they both have Dana covered.
Okay. Yeah, I like betting as well. There's still going to be room to play future streets, so there's no, you know, danger in being trapped by like a check shove by an awkward stack size, something like that.
Mm. I mean, one small factor is that we do have blockers to a draw, so since we're big enough to run a bluff, we have to worry less about running into the hand that we're representing. But for the most part, I think it's just the standard reasons to bet. What do you think, Andrew?
I don't disagree with betting, but I'm gonna play devil's advocate with you and try to make a case for checking, because I think there is a case to be made. So one thing is, I don't think we have to be that worried about free cards. Obviously, an ace is not a real pleasant card. I'm not often inclined to put limp callers on aces, but I think in a live game, you're more likely to see that than online, that somebody is just, you know, limping in with ace six or something like that, or even a better ace than that, ace jack. But, you know, a king is going to give you an open-ended straight draw. An ace is still going to give you a gut shot. An ace is not really a good card, but there's only going to be a couple of those in the deck, especially if somebody's already holding one, which is what would make it a bad card, or a big part of what would make it a bad card. And then there are also a number of cards that are going to that could potentially make somebody a pair or a draw. You know, here, when you're betting with jacks, there's only so many hands that are worse than your jacks that you're going to get action from. And granted, there's value in making the button get out from behind you with whatever he has. There's value in making people fold ace X or king X, or even making people fold pocket sixes if they weren't going to put more money in the pot with that hand. But in general, you know, I think you're probably only going to be 50-50 or maybe even a little worse than 50-50 if your bet gets called on this flop. So there's equity in folding, but when called, I'm not too thrilled about your hand, especially if it's the button who calls you. I mean, certainly he can have a 10, but I think he can very easily have any number of queens as well, which have you buried.
Hey, don't you think a lot of gut shots will call, like ace jack, king nine, ace king from the button, maybe even like nine eight especially. Yeah, I think some people might just fold a naked gut shot, but especially if they have one over. But that said, I'm not sure I see people fold 8-9 to one bet on the flop a lot in this spot.
I mean, I wouldn't be so sure that we can't get value from pocket sixes now that we won't be able to get later, and that's a hand that is not going to dry out on us very often. Certainly at a 1-2 game in Las Vegas, I would not expect any pair to fold by default. I would be assuming most people are continuing with any pair.
Okay, that addresses the second point I was going to make, which is that, you know, checking might help you to get action from second best hands, but I think you're probably right that those hands, there's a fair chance those hands aren't folding the flop anyway, and the turn for the smaller pairs, the turn could certainly get scary. I mean, the fact of checking the flop might make a pocket pair feel better, but the turn card, if it's any overcard to their pair, even if it's not really that plausible that you would have like 9-7 and check the flop and then bet a 7 turn, I think a lot of people are just going to look at it as like, well, now there's 3 overcards to my 6s, yeah, so I fold. They're not really going to think about whether the 7 hit your range or not. I think betting probably is better, but I guess I can see a bit of a case for checking as sort of a pot control slash giving people more confidence when they have second best hands. It would also depend a little bit on how straightforward I thought the button was. If I felt like I could check and fold to a bet from button, which I wouldn't do without a read, but there are some players whom I think if they bet there, my jacks would be in bad enough shape that I could just fold. So having that extra information, and also if I could be confident that he didn't have a queen if he checked, where I could essentially check and get very valuable free information from the button, I think that would be a case for checking as well, rather than making the very big mistake of putting money into the pot when it turns out he has a queen. But you'd need, I think, a pretty solid read on button to have that kind of to make that sort of play.
Just to boost your devil's advocacy here for a second, I do think a lot of buttons, even if the set of hands they bet with is more varied, they'll bet different amounts with queens and when they're just taking a stab at it. So I think a lot of people give you a lot of information with their bet sizing there. So that would be another argument for checking.
Yeah, that's I definitely agree with that. You know, not knowing anything more about the button, you know, we're going to be able to tell a lot of things physically from them and from their bet, I would say. their comfort level.
But I still like betting better.
Yeah, I do. I think checking for information is an underrated place, especially when you're playing live and you're playing with people who aren't real good at concealing things like physical tells and bet sizing tells. When it's close, which here maybe it's not that close, but when it's close, I will generally take a line that involves checking to my opponents. Like I'm very rarely dunking in a live cash game against weak players because I think there's often a lot of information to get from seeing how that continuation bet versus if you dunk bet generally. You're putting money into the pot before you have a chance to gather that information. It's kind of like giving yourself a position.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think when you decrease the skill level of your opponents, I think more of the reasons to bet go away than the reasons to check do. So checking often gets better. What were you going to say, Gareth?
I was going to ask Andrew if one of the main criteria for him thinking that Jax would benefit from this is, you know, our equity is so bad against a queen.
Yeah, that's a huge part of it.
So if he had like a more robust hand, like ace-jack, I guess would be a better example. Like this checking wouldn't enter, though I guess ace-jack needs, you know, doesn't necessarily have showdown value.
Yeah, that's the biggest factor there is that there's so much more, you gain so much more by winning the pot immediately when you have ace-jack or king-jack than you do when you have jacks. But then there's also the converse of if your opponents are, which these guys probably aren't, but if your opponents are good enough hand readers that your check is going to indicate that you don't have, I mean, betting is definitely the better way to keep your range wide. So if in circumstances where you're concerned about concealing information from decent hand readers, I also think you would want to bet because checking and then putting any more money into the pot is giving away a lot of information that you probably have a medium strength hand like jacks. So in the actual hand, Dana said that he bet $16, so 16 into 26. I think that's a pretty decent bet size for the situation. The button calls and under the gun folds. So now $59 less the rake is in the pot. The turn is an offsuit 7, so that makes the board queen, 10, 4, 7, all different suits. $59, maybe a little less in the pot. Now what are we doing?
I'm definitely checking. In this situation, though, with a Badoogie board, I worry about the number of pure floats that he can have, like, you know, just like backdoor. There's no obvious flush draw, but there could be a lot of backdoor hands that he could call on the button. I'm certainly worried about narrowing his turn calling range to better. So I feel like betting is really an option that needs to be scrutinized and taken off the table. So I'm just going to be worried about folding out the hands that we have crushed and then putting in money against a hand we have two outs against. Does that make sense? Yeah.
I mean, pretty often I'll have some kind of read that makes me want to bet, like he has exactly a 10 and we'll call again. Or there'll be guys who will give me very reliable information if I bet, and I want that. I think
a lot depends, I think, on how he calls the flop.
Yeah, but as a default, knowing nothing else about this person, I think, except that he's a tightish 1-2 opponent, I think checking is not bad. I have to say I'd like the answer that I think I like the plan that our correspondent.
Yeah, this is interesting, and I agree with you guys about checking. Dana says, I didn't really feel like building a big pot out of position with my second pair hand, which is pretty much what Gareth was saying. But at the same time, I didn't feel like completely giving up on the hand and giving myself a weak table image. So I asked myself, if I am ahead, how much value do I really want out of this hand, or how much would I call if this was the river and he bet? To me, it seemed like about half pot. So I decided to bet $12, which this confused me because that's like 1/5 of the pot. I think maybe he's saying, like between the turn and the river, he was going to end up betting about half of the pot.
Yeah, that's what I think he means.
That's the best I can, the most sense I can make of that. So he says, I decided to bet $12 into about 60. If he raised, I was going to fold. He called without too much thought. How do you guys like the underbet?
I think there are definitely situations for it. There are a lot of people who will call with anything they have and never raise you with worse, no matter how suspicious they are that it's a blocking bet. I do have this sort of obvious concern that on the flop, I sighted the presence of a lot of gut shots as a reason for betting, and betting a fifth of the pot out of position is not exactly a good way to punish a gut shot. So,
well, I mean, compared to checking, it's, I mean, you're still charging him more than if he gets to see the river for free.
Yeah, that's right. I guess I do like some of the thinking behind the play, but I have my reservations too. There's a non-answer for you. What do you think, Gareth?
No, I feel similarly in that there are certainly new problems that could be created. One of the nice things about the player type is we shouldn't expect him to create those new problems for us necessarily. But one thing that doesn't necessarily solve is we don't cap his range to exclude a queen in terms of a tight live player. If you made this kind of bet online, I think against a lot of just really weak online non-competent players, you could sometimes exclude top pair.
Like if he doesn't raise, you mean, then you can.
Yeah, if he doesn't raise, sorry. Yeah, if he doesn't raise. And yeah, on the seven, a lot of his floats probably, well, I know 9-8 picked up an open ender. So there is.
Jack 9 picked up a double getter.
Yeah, there is a lot of value in punishing his floats with a bet as opposed to checking and getting a bet out of his floats or letting them check behind. By floats, I just mean hands that certainly would be candidates to fold on the flop if he was playing quote-unquote solid. So if we never think we're getting bluff-raised, and that seems like a pretty good assumption, then this, you know, we this might just be a place to play our hand in equity in a very, very straightforward way that won't be taken advantage of.
Yeah, I mean, I think this does address your concern about having villain fold a lot of hands that are worse than yours. If you'd made a more, you know, quote, normal sized bet, probably you're not going to get villain folding like pocket sixes. If he called the flop with it, he's probably not folding the turn, getting 5-1 or 6-1. So yeah, it does address that concern. I come back again to what I was saying about checking for information on the flop, because once again, you're missing the opportunity to. Because I mean, I can envision check folding the turn depending on what and how villain bets. So the more that I felt I was getting good reads off of villain with his physical behavior and his tells, the more inclined I would be to check and just see what he does without having a real clear plan. And probably calling a bet, but being prepared to fold if I got the heebie-jeebies.
Yeah, if we check and he makes a big bet and we have two jacks in our hand, removing a lot of the hands that need to bluff big, I would definitely agree with you.
Yeah, that seems right. Again, this gets back to our read on the button. I think a lot of people will make a half-hearted bet with a lot of hands there, thinking that you have ace-king and that they have some obligation to bet against that hand.
If you're never going to check-fold the turn, I think this might be better than check-calling.
Right, but if you're comfortable with check-folding, given a certain read on his sizing and physicality, then...
Yeah, otherwise, like if you really have no idea what it's going to mean if he bets the turn and you're going to feel obligated to call, I can see more value in this because it prevents him from taking any free cards and it doesn't really give him the opportunity to control the pot. And this is, as we've emphasized, something that's really only going to work against a not very good player who's never going to raise here or from whom a raise will very clearly indicate that you're beaten. Yeah. So he says that villain called without too much thought. What do you guys make of that?
I would imagine that's either a worse queen, a 10, possibly a good draw, or even a 6. I mean, so I think that could be any pair, slightly less likely to be a good top pair, slightly less likely to be bottom pair. I think if he called without too much thought, it's probably not a gut shot either, probably. So I would say good draw, 10, slightly less likely to be top pair, slightly less likely to be a worse pair, but any pair is very possible.
I think this helps with Gareth's argument when Gareth was saying we probably can't cap his range based on the fact that he just calls. I do think we can probably cap his range based on this. Unfortunately, we can't cap it at a set containing no queens, but I do think we can say he probably doesn't have ace, queen, king, queen, or better.
Really, I was going to say that he probably can't have a hand better than ace, queen, but that he could potentially have ace, queen.
I think he could have ace, queen.
He was described as a tightish player, or by virtue of the fact that this was the first pot he was entering. I mean, I think a lot of players playing these stakes like really don't have a raise button for this kind of situation. They're sort of showdown monkeys in a way.
Yeah.
They want to get to the river where they're going to play a new game called Did I Win? And
that's a very good way of putting that.
Yeah. So, I mean, it really honestly would depend on like the player's age for me a lot. But if he's older than 30, I would think he would have ace queen a decent amount of the time.
Yeah. So, that's a good point. Would your answer change if there were more flush draws possible on the board?
Yes.
Because I'm looking at the board, I'm seeing a lot of straight draws, and I'm thinking maybe if he has ace queen, he's going to think like, oh, this guy could be on some kind of draw, and he's betting so weak. You know, I feel like I have to raise to like charge the draws.
I would discount it a little bit more, but I still wouldn't discount it completely just because, like Gareth said, I mean, however strange your line looks, people just don't want to raise the turn into somebody who's made three aggressive actions with one pair. So more flush draws would make me discount it more, but certainly not remove ace queen from my range. Although I'm probably more skeptical than Gareth is of, I'm probably between you guys on the probability of ace queen.
It would definitely be more discounted just by virtue of that fact. I don't know to what extent though. So.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You guys convinced me on that point. So now we see the river, and the river is a deuce. So now we have queen, 10, 7, 4, deuce, no flush is possible. There's $73 in the pot. No, $83 in the pot. Probably 80 after the rake. And Dana said he bet $12 again. What do you want to do now?
I know the results, so why doesn't Gareth take the first swing at this one?
This is a pretty interesting spot because we've played in certainly online, I would think, against some poor players who I knew what their VPIP was and that it was high. I would think, oh, I can check call this river because I've just kept his range so wide and he just is going to have missed the board so much on this total blank. But against like a tighter live player, you know, one thing is we can't really expect the value of a bluff to be that high because, one, we might not be comfortable check calling large sizes, and two, if he does bluff small, we don't win very much. On the other hand, you know, we've played our hand in a way that suggests, you know, we could only bet one third pot for value if we're going to bet for value and we fold all his air. So I'm not really too sure at the moment. This would be the part where I'd be in the tank on the river thinking, what have I done? What have I created?
This could be fancy play, but I can think of a lot of people who are a bit suspicious. And after they called the turn, I would strongly suspect that they had a worse hand. I think this might be a spot to bet a lot on the river, actually, to bet the whole pot or even a little bit more, like bet 100 or something, because I mean, largely to get a suspicious call from a 10 or something that thinks you have ace king. Then also, given that there are plenty of queens in his range, he could just fold those.
Right.
Yeah, I do think there's something to be said for overbetting against a lot of opponents here. But I also I'm
skeptical about this plan of making him fold queens but call with tens.
Sometimes. No, I mean, if he's skeptical.
Things could go well and he could.
I mean, I think a lot of the time, if he folds a 10, it's because, I mean, I think you want to polarize the range that you are representing and let him make a mistake. I mean, I certainly don't think that there's any individual person who will fold a queen and call with a 10, but I do think that you'll provoke a what the fuck response from him, and he'll think that you either have aces or three queens or ace king. And a lot of good things can happen when you do that.
But I feel like more often than not, people are like this sort of player is more likely to make his decision based on the strength of his hand.
Yeah.
Like he's not going to.
I think that's right, but not when you surprise him, not when you wake him up with a big bet.
Then he actually tries to do some hand reading.
Yeah.
No, I think he's going to wake up by like throwing his cards towards the muck as fast as possible and give a disgusted like look on his face, you know?
Okay. Like, so if I, so if you actually did have a whiff, then it would be a good time for a big bet, maybe?
I suppose, yeah. If you want to fold, like, up to Queen Jack, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, this would be a good... This would be... Yeah, I think he's going to respond with his range pretty proportionately to our bet size. So I think if you want to get him to fold King-Queen, you should bet all the chips and hope it's profitable. And if you want him to call with worse, you should bet less chips.
This is interesting. I mean, I often have a crazy image at the table or people think I'm crazy. So when I get into a situation like this, like they feel invested in the hand, even though it's not a huge pot. And if I think that they're getting stubborn with middle pair, this is where I pull out the ammo and get full value. Just because like they already made it to the river. What are they going to do? Fold now?
You think he's just going to call $100 with sixes?
It's been known to happen. It's,
it's, that's what I was going to say. He really needs to call with eights and sixes, like a fair amount of the time, I would think, for this to be to make up for the times he doesn't fold ace queen.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like we're already not wildly ahead of his calling range. Like, if, right. Even if we bet, and, you know, just to I'll advance it this far to say that Dana ended up betting $12 again. So even in that circumstance where he's probably calling with any pair, I don't think we're wildly ahead of his calling range, like maybe 65-35 or something.
Yeah.
That sounds good. So, I mean, when we start making a bigger bet that, yeah, if he calls with 100% of that range, no matter how much we bet, then betting bigger is obviously better. But he doesn't have to fold that much to shift it to the point where we're not a favorite against the calling range anymore. Like, even if he just folds away, throws away the pocket pairs and calls with all of his tens and all of his queens when we overbet, I don't think there's a lot of value in that.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that both of you disagree with me and that my response is probably colored a bit by my personal experience in this kind of situation, which is that a lot of times I know they have a 10 or worse and will call me. But yeah, I mean, given everything you've said, I think I like what our correspondent did.
I like betting more chips than are in the pot, but I don't think this is the time or place really, but or image for our correspondent. I'm not so sold on $12. I think if we check and he's going to make a quote unquote hopeless bluff at the pot with all his eight nines and ace jacks and king nine, like basically everything that we kept in the pot with our turn bet size, it's going to be for more than $12 and with a higher frequency of us being good with a check call. Like I think if we check and he bets $24, $25, that's going to be error very often, and we're going to have achieved something with our turn size. And if we check and he bets $45 or $50 or something like that, then we can start to groan and think about check folding.
I would shift back to calling if you get a lot over 50 though. If he bets, I think we said there was 80 or so in the pot. If he bets more than 60, I'd say I'm back in the calling camp again.
Yeah,
I don't see him bombing it with one pair, and I think he's pretty unlikely to have better than that.
I think that makes a lot of sense. I think the curve actually does go in that way. I think he'll make a lot of hopeless bluffs for a small size, and then
you're getting better pot odds, so he doesn't need to be bluffing as much.
Yeah, and then on occasion, he'll make a big bluff, but he'll never, like you said, he'll never bet huge with one pair.
Yeah, although if he's tight, he might just want to see if ace high is good, and that's going to be a lot of his gut shots. So then I'm back to starting to wonder if we should bet to get value out of a 10 or something like that. But
that's my biggest concern, is him checking behind 10s if we check, because I think that he has to bluff often enough to make up for the times that he checks back to 10.
Yeah.
So my thinking was probably to value bet like the most the most that'll definitely be called by a 10 and that could be called by a suspicious smaller pair than a 10, which I think would probably be more on the order of a third of the pot, somewhere between $25 and $30.
Yeah, 28 was the number I had in mind.
Me too.
I was going to say 19, but no. I think your numbers are probably better.
Yeah, so I do like the idea of betting again, but I think the 12 is kind of unnecessarily small. I think at this point you can still be playing your hand as a value hand, and this feels a little bit more like Hero here is just trying to block or to get to showdown very easily, as opposed to get value out of his hand, which I think there's still room to do. You're not a big favorite, but you know, any favorite, you still want to bet the most that you can get and still keep his range wide enough that you are a favorite.
Let's talk about the psychology. Don't bet because you think you have to win every pot or else ruin your image. But here I go jumping the gun again, and Gareth wants to say
let's
something.
Let's just give you the results, and then we'll let Nate talk about image.
No, that's it.
So he says, villain kind of shrugged, and in parentheses he had, and it felt like the whole table was making a collective, huh? I bet. And called. I showed and he mucked. My guess is he had ace-10, jack-10, 10-9, king-jack, or jack-9, although ace-10 seems most likely. Yeah, so I mean, a good outcome for him. We talked already about what we thought we should do on the river. So let's come back and talk about this point where he says that the reason he didn't want to check and give up on the turn was that he would give himself a weak table image.
So I don't mean this personally, but this is a bad sign in terms of the mindset that you bring to a poker table, both that you're worried about losing any pot in which you raised, and so you throw money at the pot in order to keep from ruining your image. And then second on the river, when you have the whole table going, huh? I mean, that does happen sometimes, but I can't help but wonder if that was just all in his head, and that he sort of thought that everybody was looking at him and that he was really worried about what other people were thinking of him. I would bet that the whole table, in fact, was not.
Yeah, many of them probably were not paying attention to the river action at all.
Yeah, it sounds like there's, first of all, just some false beliefs about what constitutes a good image and a bad image. Losing one pot does not, quote unquote, ruin your image. And having the image of somebody who throws money at the pot and then can't take any heat, that's fine. That's something you can use to your advantage, especially in a game where you're already going to be taking advantage of people's looseness. That's only going to exaggerate their loose tendencies against you in a lot of respects. And also, it just sounds like you've got some unhealthy ego involvement in the hands you play. And so try not to do that. That could be harsh. I mean, there's a very good chance that none of this actually applies to Dana. Dana, is that his name? Dana? Yeah.
Dana.
And there's a lot of very personal sort of, in a literal sense, egocentric just language in this email. And I would urge a more reserved, detached attitude in some respects. What do you think?
When I make these, like, what's your play posts on my blog, which I do pretty frequently, and I ask people to post how they would play a certain hand and what their reasoning was, or sometimes even when people are just commenting on hands that I played that I posted, a lot of people will cite image as a reason for doing things. And I'm struggling to think of a single case where I agreed that image was an important consideration. It's really just not something like I'm much more in the camp of, I mean, be conscious of what your image is, but I don't think any one image is like way better than another one. Like knowing what your image is more important than cultivating a particular image. You can make money off of any type of image. I think it's generally better to like play your hand in the way that's best for the situation and then just deal with whatever image you end up with rather than like deviating from what would otherwise be a profitable play for the sake of trying to preserve some image.
Couldn't agree more. I have one exception, which is that in a tournament, if you can somehow, and this requires luck, but if you can somehow get the image of somebody who actually has it when you're stealing blinds, like if you can somehow make people think that you're not stealing blinds light, since stealing blinds is all of what a tournament is, then that's awesome and you should really cultivate it. That's pretty much the only time when I think you can think about sort of setting out to, you know, keep from showing a hand when you were stealing light. You know, it still takes the right situation, but that's,
yeah. And an extension of that would be convincing people that you're not going to fold to re-steals. But the thing is, it's very expensive to actually not fold to re-steals.
Yeah.
So like the best way to cultivate that image would be just to like arbitrarily call somebody shove when you don't have the right odds to do it with a bad hand. But I don't really suggest doing that either.
I mean, one way you can do that, though, is to know everybody's stack beforehand and know when you're going to call a re-steal.
Yeah, so if you just like, if you have a correct call with like king nine, but you like snap call,
yeah,
call.
Exactly. Just like throw like, I mean, you have to be really careful that they aren't giving off physical information, that they don't have big chips hidden. I mean, this can backfire, but if you're really in control of the situation, if somebody reshoves, then you just put a stack of like 100K stack of red in the pot with queen four suited or something, boom, call. Like that can, I mean, even if people know what's going on, it's a fairly vivid image that can linger with them.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, those are pretty unique situations and often limited to tournaments. And I think Andrew's right that it's actually hard to construct a scenario where you should do something just for your image or not do something just for your image.
Yeah, I mean, if people see you playing a hand live in a strange way or see you doing things that there actually is a collective, huh? I mean, that's a great thing. Like, that's just... I've had that happen, and some of my best live sessions come as a result of that. And in terms of if the turn was actually a check fold, say we construct some scenario where we check fold a hand with marginal showdown value, you know, having bluff catching lines in your game or good recognizing good spots with in which to bluff catch or to induce bluff raises or bluffs in general, just a perfect way to combat an image of weakness if you just so happen to build one by virtue of playing correctly. I don't know if anyone agrees with that, but that would be my advice to Dana.
Sounds
yeah,
good.
No, I think that's good. I think we've covered this pretty thoroughly. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds good. It's
cool. Well, Dana, thanks very much for the question, and sorry it's taken me like a year to get around to answering it, but now you got an audio answer instead of the text answer, and probably much shorter text answer you would have gotten from just one person.
Yeah, and I'm sure you're awesome. I'm sure you're a great player. Didn't mean to be harsh, but you know, just I was talking to another person who would have written the same email as you with all these unhealthy attitudes that I'm sure you don't have. So.
Well, great stuff from Gareth. Thanks again to him for coming on.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks to Gareth. Kudos for being so honest. Thank you for being so honest. What struck you about that, Andrew?
You know, it's interesting because I've talked to Gareth about that segment of his life, you know, these most recent couple years of his life since he's been playing poker. I've heard that story from him a couple of times, and I actually even, before you and I started this podcast, as you know, Nate, because I wasted your time with this as well. I recorded a one-on-one interview with Gareth for a solo podcast that I briefly considered doing. And then I think this worked out much better with the two of us doing this together. But so, you know, I asked him about some of the same things, and this came across much better. I think largely a result of us being a little more experienced interviewing than I was at that time. But so every time that I hear him tell this story, I get some new details out of it, which is, you know, it's kind of like peeling an onion or something. it all starts to make a little bit more sense, or you know, you feel like you start to understand him a little bit more each time. But yeah, I mean, I just think the whole idea of doing something as drastic as, you know, moving to a different country where you don't really speak the language. I mean, I don't think he spoke Spanish very well at all when he first moved to Peru. And I think he has gotten better at it since being there. But, you know, to go to a place where you don't speak the language that well, where you've never been before, right? I guess he had been there briefly backpacking. But, you know, it's a pretty foreign place to you to just decide that you're going to up and move there, not really know where you're going to stay. And just kind of be counting on making money from poker. I mean, having some money in your pocket, but just having so much that you're going to have to figure out on the fly. It's a pretty ballsy thing to do. And you know, I've done a decent amount of nomadic sort of fly by the seat of your pants sort of stuff in the last couple of years, in terms of, you know, not always knowing where I was going to be sleeping the next night or something like that. But really, nothing even remotely on the scale of what he's done. So I think it's a really courageous thing to do, and I think it indicates a lot of strength of character and just, I don't know, it's, someone who would do that is guaranteed to be an interesting person, I think.
I think that's right. I'm also interested in, I don't think there are any easy or simple answers to this, but I do think that for poker to seem to you to be the best option you have professionally. I think some interesting things have to be true about what motivates you and what you value and what you want. And I think that entails that there are some commonalities among poker players. And again, I don't think it's anything that can be stated simply, but that's one thing I wanted to explore with this podcast is what ties the poker world together might well be some common set of priorities or beliefs or values or motives that cause people who are very different, you know, to pursue this. To play a card game for a living, to devote a lot of spare time to a card game. Even casual players are often like this. That's why I asked him the possibly shocking or insulting question, why do you get out of bed in the morning, roughly? Not that I thought that he didn't have a reason, but I think these things are different for somebody like Gareth than for, you know, a lot of other people. You know, he doesn't have kids. He doesn't have an ordinary job or anything like this. And, you know, he's in a lot of ways an aesthete. So, but no, it was good. So I'm really grateful to him. Thanks to all our listeners, and especially those of you who stuck around long enough to hear my voice now. We want emails, we want hands to talk about, we want your questions, we want your angry rants, we want all of it. podcast@thinkingpoker.net. If you listen through iTunes, please rate and review us. Big thanks again to Gareth, to whom we wish safe travels and a nice upswing. And thanks also to Bubblegum Octopus, who was nice enough to give us permission to use his music. Fun stuff, nice video game aesthetic. If you poke around the web, you'll see a fun retro vibe with a lot of what he does. You can find him on Facebook and MySpace, and also at Bubblegum Octopus, all one word, bubblegumoctopus.bandcamp.com. Until next Monday, here's a song called Betrayal is Okay.